Hello, I'm Philip, and this is The Bear Den, the American Bear Association podcast, where we talk about all things bears, and, as you'll hear, wildlife in general. In the last episode, I talked about my own experiences working with wildlife in Indonesia, and now I want to shine the spotlight on some of the people that I've met out there. I keep in mind what Clarie, co-founder of the ABA, said in our chat at the end of the first series. Please check out those episodes if you haven't already. She talked about people getting out and making a difference. And really, if it weren't for the ABA, I probably wouldn't have ended up doing what I've done. So over the next few episodes, we'll be hearing from some of the people who have inspired me and have got out there and made a difference. I also love hearing and sharing people's stories. Firstly, we welcome Femke Den Haas into the Bear Den, founder of the Jakarta Animal Aid Network, also known as JAN. She has been based in Indonesia for over 20 years, advocating for animal rights, fighting against the illegal wildlife trade, and not only has she helped rescue bears, but also orangutans, many different species of birds, monkeys, dolphins. The list goes on, and we cover this in our talk, which I have split into two episodes, as it was a long chat. I think, in the spirit of Vinschuti, the fact that the Vinschuti Sanctuary isn't just a bear sanctuary, it's the Vinschuti Wildlife Sanctuary, I've approached these episodes with an eye to include other animals besides sun bears, although obviously they hold a special place in my heart. The flora and fauna in Indonesia is so diverse and interconnected in the great circle of life, you might say. That's enough of my rambling. Get on with it, Philip. In this first episode, we talk about how Femke got set up in Indonesia and cover some of Jan's projects such as bird rehabilitation and the Free the Bali Dolphins campaign, which saw a first-of-its-kind release of dolphins back to the wild. Thank you for your indulgence, and I hope you enjoy. As a side note, there will be talk of animals kept in terrible conditions, so I don't want to sugarcoat that, as it can be hard to hear and it does hurt my heart, but it is necessary to understand the situation. We also hear the other side of this, when these animals are rescued, and the joy and hope that that brings, and knowing that things are getting better. There is a place in the remote northwoods of Minnesota, North America. It's located near the town of Orr, population approximately 300. Outside of this town is an area where normal rules are put to one side. It's a place where humans and wildlife meet. It's a special place, wholly unique and not without its controversies. This is the Vinschuti Wildlife Sanctuary, run by the American Bear Association, ABA for short. The ABA is dedicated to promoting a better understanding of black bears and all wildlife through education, observation, and experience. I'm your host, Philip Stubley, and welcome to the Bear Den. So I have seen you described as the most effective activist in Indonesia, and I do think that's quite an apt description, as you've been a real force for change. Wow. You're a real force for change in Indonesia.
What an honor.
Oh, we're honored, Femke. Is it Femke? It's Femke, right? Not Femke.
Yeah, correct.
Right. Yeah, I think I've been hanging around too many Australians who all say Femke recently.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm used to it. My name changes wherever I go.
So. I bet. Similar. So Femke, it's my pleasure to welcome you into the Bear Den. I was almost tempted to rename it the Bruang Den for this.
That would be nice.
We still might. I honestly don't know where to start because I've got so much I want to ask you about. But I suppose we'll start with if you could first of all introduce yourself and just tell us where you're speaking to us from. It'd be lovely.
Yeah. So my name is Femke Den Haas. I'm born in Africa, in Cameroon. I was raised in Holland and I have Dutch citizenship. And I came to Indonesia the first time when I was 16. I was always attracted to, you know, work in conservation and animal rescue. And since I was a little girl, I was horrified when I saw animals suffering and people didn't do anything about it. I just always felt like I wanted to help. So, you know, if anything in my neighborhood when I was a little girl, I wanted to reach out and help. So it was sort of in me, you know, to work in animal rescue and from a very young age. And so then I came to Indonesia at 16 and I was introduced to the amazing, incredible rainforests of Indonesia and the animals that live within. And then I was determined to come back and to help to protect this beautiful ecosystem and all the animals that live here.
Oh, lovely. So, like, yeah, so when you first visited Indonesia, you kind of always thought, I'm going to be coming back here. There was something specifically about Indonesia itself that you knew you wanted to go back to.
Yeah, the being in the rainforest was just magical. Every corner has life and sounds, and the rainforest is just full of surprises, and it's just so incredibly beautiful. Yeah, I was just, you know, I was just so, yeah, like I said, it was just so magical to be there, and it made such a big impression on me. And then afterwards, finding out the horrific trade that is happening to all these animals that live there, and the way how they're being caught and traded, it's so brutal. It's so horrifying. And then I thought, okay, I really want to do something about this. And I had no idea yet how. I was just determined to help and to help protect the rainforest and the animals living within. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So, and you said you've grew up, well, you seem like you were a bit of a nomad even from childhood. And so I'm just wondering, how many languages do you actually speak now?
Well, I used to speak really good French, but I lost it a bit since I've been living in Indonesia. But I speak Bahasa and I speak English and then I speak Dutch.
No, no, it's still one more than me. Was it hard to learn Indonesian?
To learn Indonesian was not really hard for me because I was actually living in the jungle for 6 months. And in the beginning when I heard, so I was with this Indonesian team of people. And when they were speaking Bahasa Indonesia, it sounded like a language from a different, you know, planet. Like it was so different from, you know, what I'm used to. So the words and the, but then when I started to understand a few words, it all made so much sense. And it just became so easy to learn it then because there's no complicated grammar. You know, it's like I'm walking and he's walking. Yesterday I'm walking. It's all the same. You know, you don't say there. Yeah, it's very easy in a way. And it's a fun language to learn. One bruang, satu bruang, you know, one bear.
Yeah.
Dua bruang. You don't say bears. Like there's no, it's quite easy. And there's loads of words from Holland in the language. So that's why it was so, funny and for me to learn. Like there's old-fashioned words in there that you know we would never use anymore, but yeah, they use it and so yeah, it went quite quick actually once I started to understand a few words, and I was brave enough to try, you know, because that's always another issue which I often see with people when they come here. It's not just about, you know, being really good in learning languages, but you really need to be brave enough to just try, you know, and just, if you make mistakes, you shouldn't care, you know, you should keep trying. So that's what I did. And, but I didn't really have a choice because I was working just with Indonesian people and yeah, else I felt all alone. So I just had to learn it. And we were actually following orangutans in the time. So I had this spreadsheet with all the words that orangutans would do in Bahasa Indonesia. And I was translating them one by one with the team members, you know, just in the forest, trying to explain what everything meant. And that's how I started. So, you know, sit, the orangutan was sitting, duduk. And so all these words, the orangutan was making a nest and eating. And yeah, I started from that. So I started from orangutan observation work. Yeah, understanding the language in the end. So yeah, I speak really good Bahasa now. But I mean, I've been here so long and I spent most of my time, you know, with the local communities and yeah, and my husband, of course, is from here, so.
It was a similar situation for me. When I first came over, I was by myself, and obviously there were a few English speakers, but I wanted to make the effort, and I did think I need to, and it was kind of obviously just working with the bear caregivers and the orangutan caregivers, you just kind of slowly just, something clicks after a while, and as you say, it's relatively a bit simpler language to learn. I found a lot of it's contextual. You use the word, and depending on the context you're in, then everyone understands what you're saying. As well,
and if they don't, then they laugh about it.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I would.
I mean, I traveled to countries where people would get upset, you know, if I didn't pronounce something right, or they just wouldn't talk to me even if I was trying, you know. And these are really harsh situations. They're like, hey, I'm really trying here, you know. In Indonesia, you never get a reaction like that. People are always nice, and yeah, as long as you're trying, you know, they appreciate that. So.
Yeah, I believe so. And I would actually sometimes I would do silly things, like I would do direct translations of, say, idioms in
Oh,
English,
yeah.
and I'd trying to see if it made sense, and I'd just get these funny looks. Like there were one time we were sitting in a car, and I was like, we're all packed in the back, and I said, oh, we're like sardines, just spaghetti sardines in it, because obviously in English, like, that would people would understand. I see you're packed in, and I just got these
Yeah.
funny looks saying you're like a sardine, like they thought I was saying I am a sardine. But yeah, it is a fun language, and I've actually been over the last couple of weeks, I've got into Duolingo, so I've been doing that whole thing a few just like 5 minutes a day, just to kind of keep it fresh.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, but oh, thank
Yeah.
you, that's so cool. How long has it you've been in Indonesia now?
Yeah, I came here the first time 96, and then I returned in 2002. So I've been here now full time since 2002, so 23 years. I had no plan or to stay here that long. I just came here to help. To start up a rescue center, and I had no idea how things would work out, you know. And I have to say, it's been like a roller coaster. It's been quite hard sometimes, especially in the beginning, because animal rescue work was still really misunderstood, and animal welfare was, you know, nobody knew what animal welfare meant. Or so it was really challenging in the beginning, because here I was, you know, trying to expose these issues that, you know, not really anyone cared about, or some people cared about it, but yeah, it was sort of new. So, but I'm happy that we pulled through, you know, we meaning like me and my small team of people in the beginning, with who I still stand strong until today. Yeah.
Oh, fab. So yeah, we've mentioned it. So I guess from 2002, I'm assuming Jakarta Animal Aid Network, JAN, which you are the founder of, like how did that come together? Like what were the challenges of getting that set up, and how you established your mission?
Yeah, so actually, the story started in 2002 that I returned to Indonesia by invitation of the Ministry of Forestry and Environment, because, and this is a really long story, but I'm gonna try to explain
I've got time.
it, you know, briefly. So when I was here the first time in 96, and I spent time at the orangutan center, and I still had to go back, return to Holland to finish high school. I mean, I really stopped going to high school just to be able to visit this center and to stay there and help. You know, I just really wanted to do that, and not everybody agreed, including my parents in the beginning, but I did it. And after I went returned to Holland, finished high school, and I started to volunteer at this primate rescue center in Holland, which is one of the biggest primate rescue centers in Europe. It's called Stichting AAP, UP. And while I was in Jakarta the first time, so when I went to the orangutan center, I had met this amazing lady. Her name is Puk Smoetser. And Puk Smoetser lives in the house, which is now the Australian International School in Jakarta. So you can imagine how big her house was. She was very wealthy, but I had no idea. I was going to visit her just because I learned about her, because she loves animals, and she was helping animals. And she welcomed me with open arms, even though I just stood in front of the door, like, you know, rang the bell, because in the time, you know, we didn't call each other, or I mean, I had a landline, and I spoke to someone living in a house to say I'm coming, but, you know, it was really different, right? So you just showed up, and I had no idea if, you know, how she was and how she was living. I just knew she liked animals and she was helping animals. And then she showed me everything she did that one day. She helped animals in the zoo, in Ragunan Zoo, because they were living in horrific cages. And like the elephants were always tied up. And then she created with her money islands where the elephants could feel water, could feel grass, could feel sunlight. And she did all these amazing things for the animals, just because she cared and because she had the money to help. And she also started the first rescue center for dogs, in Jakarta, dogs and cats. So she did a lot, and she showed me everything that one day. And then 3 years later, I was in Holland. I was 2.5 years later, and I was going to the, I was on my way to the Primate Rescue Center volunteering, and I received a phone call that she was very ill and she was in the hospital in Holland. And so I went to see her, and then she asked me if, you know, if I don't, yeah, if I don't make it, let's say, because she was very, very ill, I would like you to help me set up the rescue centers in Indonesia and like sort of realize my dream. And with me, there was also Willy. So we were two persons that she trusted. He was also Dutch, but he's been living in Indonesia for many years. He was also in the hospital at that very moment.
That's Willy Smits, right? Yeah.
Yes. And so that's exactly what happened. When she passed away, I received an invitation to come to Indonesia and to help realize her dream. And then we started the first rescue centers with her heritage, let's say, with her trust fund. And those are now still six existing rescue centers all over Indonesia, different locations. Two of them had to shut down later because of financial issues. Four are still running, and it's not easy, but they're still running. I mean, finances for rescue work is always a struggle. But the beginning years, you know, the fact that she managed to, yeah, it's all because we have to thank her, you know, because she made it happen. If these rescue centers wouldn't have been, you know, wouldn't have started, then animals would not have a place to go. So in the time, animals that would be confiscated on the Jakarta airport, for example, because there was nowhere to go, they would either go to a zoo or, in most cases, the traders could continue their travels with the animals, but they would pay a fine. So when the rescue center was founded right next to the airport, and this is where I focus my work, then those animals entered the center, and then the trader could be still fined or even, you know, sentenced. And but at least the animals were taken away from him. So it was very new, and yeah, and that's what I worked hard for, you know, to realize the center and to have standards. And if the animals come in, where do they go after? And in Indonesia, the biodiversity is so incredible. I mean, there's so many different species. And I was blown away by the different species that I would be working with, because some of them I didn't even know existed, you know, like, and that's why I had to always reach out to international experts, because it was all very new for me, and I was just really committed. And with that same team, later we founded the Jakarta Animal Aid Network. But so it sort of started there. And why I started the Jakarta Animal Aid Network was because I felt like there was more of a need to also push for change. And you cannot push for change and better regulations if you're always, if you're just a rescue center receiving animals, then you just, you know, you just run the center then. And I felt like if we are an organized, you know, an NGO that is registered in Indonesia, in Indonesian run, then we can really become a partner of the government to also push for change and, yeah, like suffering of animals by pushing for better regulations, stop like circuses with animals. For example, in that time, there was a circus that was traveling with dolphins, but also sun bears, always sun bear cubs, always young sun bears that had to ride bicycles, and otters and cockatoos. And these traveling dolphin shows, we call them the dolphin shows because they always had two dolphins, but they also had these other animals. They were traveling from city to city. And I just felt if we're not an organization and we cannot protest and we cannot raise our voices stronger and we're only a rescue center, we will never make a real difference. So that's why for me it was so important to start Ja'an. And actually the shelter where the dogs and the cats were cared for, which was also funded with the support of Puk Smutser, this amazing woman. There was a friend of mine working with the dogs and cats. And so she also stepped in to help form Ja'an as a strong organization. And she's running the domestic department. So let's say, you know, dogs and cats and the welfare of domesticated animals. And I really focus with Iben and the other team members on wildlife issues because, yeah, there's a lot of issues to work on. And it's good to not, you know, combine everything, but have it really well managed. So and so we grew into a bigger organization over the years. I think we built quite a good reputation in Indonesia, at least with Jan Indonesia. So we are the wildlife division, We work really good with the government. We have MOUs with the central government. So, and we, yeah, we still run various rescue centers and animal rescue efforts.
As a network, it sounds amazing at what you've done. I could ask you to just list all of the animals that you've rescued, but I guess we'd be here all day. Like you say, there's so many in Indonesia, but I'll probably ask you about some of the specific programs and rescues that Jan has been involved with over the years, if that's all right. There was like the one that I remember you talked about when we first met was the Brahmani kite, which is like Jakarta's mascot. And you've set up a rehabilitation program on, is it Kodok Island? For the Brahmani kite. I think that was one of the first programs you did. How did that come together?
So when we had the rescue center next to the airport, so there was it was more like a quarantine where animals would come in and out, and they would arrive in the middle of the night, you know, when they were confiscated on the airport. I mean, you always had to be standby and ready to receive animals there, and they would come in the most horrific ways. Like we had orangutans in sport bags, and we had birds inside watermelons. And you can't, you think this, you know, you think this is too crazy, and then something more crazy is happening. You know, I've seen it all in the center. So there were these Brahmini kites that also. Were confiscated on the airport. They were on their way being smuggled to Saudi Arabia. And they were all in a PVC pipe. And because in the PVC pipe, they are quiet and, you know, they can't move. And so anyway, they were caught. Luckily, the guy was caught. And these eight young Brahmini kites were handed over to our center. And I, you know, I'm always thinking of every individual when they enter the center. Where are they going to go next? Like, is there a way to release them in the future, and how? And then it was all very new for me, yeah, because I've been working in like bird rescue centers in Holland, and we've been also like treating wild birds and releasing them. But here you have very young birds that I wanted to rehabilitate and release, but I didn't know if it was possible. So I said, we have to try, you know, because else these birds will be in cages for the next 20 years. And it's just, it's horrible. So then we started to survey different areas where we could potentially start a rehabilitation center for the birds. And we went to Ujung Kulon, to the national park area. We went to different places in Java. And we went to the greater Jakarta region, which actually was in the beginning the last, let's say, my last option, because I thought, oh, it's too close to Jakarta. But then when we surveyed the greater Jakarta region, and there's this island group called the Thousand Islands, I realized that it's perfect. It was just perfect for the birds. It's coral reef, islands and fish, you know, it was beautiful. And it was this really immense, like, marine ecosystem, you know, that we found during the survey. And what was quite shocking, but which helped to start the rehabilitation program, was Brahmini kites in the region were extinct. And while before there used to be a big population of Brahmini kites, that's why Jakarta as a city has the Brahmini kite as its logo. So you can imagine, like, this bird is everywhere. If you are in Jakarta, on the buses, you see it, on the government offices, because it's the logo or the mascot of the city. But in reality, the real bird wasn't there anymore in the region. So it was quite depressing, like, you know, to find out, like, whoa, and nothing had been done about it. And then I would go to the bird markets, because we still have these horrific wet markets. So, yeah, the birds had become extinct while they are the mascot of the city. So that was very depressing. And then we said, look, we have to try to see if we can rehabilitate and bring these birds back to this region and stop the selling of these birds on the wet markets, because there's these markets in Jakarta where the birds were openly for sale. And that was quite challenging, you know, because I would have meetings with the government officials that were in charge of, you know, the area where, for example, the birds are still being sold, and the areas where we knew that, you know, traders were bringing them to, or all this. And the government reacted really mildly, like, okay, well, we are still in the socialization process of the law, we, you know, you need to be patient. But I was like, it's 2008 and the law has been there since 99. So until when are we socializing this law? You know, plus this is the mascot of the city and it's extinct. So then I just focus on these 8 birds, and we created a beautiful enclosure for them, which was like half in the sea and half on land. And it was just by, you know, using logic and just thinking logically, like, what do these birds need in case, you know, they go back to the wild? It's like they need to be able to catch their own fish. They shouldn't react to people. And then I just combine different input from people all over the world working with eagles and raptors. And we created our own protocol. And then we started this reintroduction program for the birds. And while we were working on the release of the 8 birds, and we did receive appreciation from the government then, because the minister came to like sort of open the center officially. Well, I was not thinking yet of opening a real center on the long term. I was just focusing on these 8 birds. But then I realized that you cannot do a program like this and leave, you know, after the release of the birds and say it was a success. I realized that you need to have permanent, you need to be there permanently and work with the local people. Because if you just release and go, how do you know the birds aren't caught again? How do you know that they are surviving and thriving? I mean, yes, you can still follow them for 1 or 2 months, but what happens in 6 months? What happens in a year? Are they making nests? Like, so I said, we should try to stay on the long term. And it was really challenging because I couldn't get any funding. You know, nobody cared about eagles or kites. So it was very hard to get the funding. So luckily I registered in Holland, our organization also, and through family and friends, I was just, you know, trying to get the money together to run this project. Because yeah, it was quite challenging to get, you know, the funds for it, but we managed to run it until today. Like we released over 137 birds in the whole area, the region, and we also have documentation of them breeding. We have documentation of their offspring. And what for me was most important is that we have the full support of the local community. So if they would spot anyone, even a fisherman in the middle of the sea with his boat, I would get a video. Hey, look, one of the birds is here, you know, or, oh, it was just catching a fish. And for me, that meant the world, you know, because it just shows that the people were really acknowledging the program and understood, you know, why we were doing it and cared about it. So yeah, for me, that was a big moment. Now it's very challenging because the islands are being overwhelmed with tourism development. So we are actually now moving the birds to our Sumatra center, which is sad because the birds are really happy in, you know, it's just perfect for them where they were, you know, on Kotok Island. But the island is privately owned, and we did receive, like, from the president Jokowi in 2014, we received like a plaque of appreciation, like a marmor stone, and that, you know, this project is very important. But after that, you know, people within the government change, and some have less interest, and that's what's happening now. So yeah, it's not easy for us, and it's not easy for the birds that are still in our care, because it means we need to move now after 20 years. But on the other hand, I'm proud of all the results so far, because we did reintroduce a stable population. So, you know, if you look at it from that way, I just think it was a success, and I hope it stays that way, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've done it once, you can do it again. And obviously there's, over those 20 years, like all those individuals, all 137, and then you've got all, you know, all the offspring from them as well that have benefited. It cascades all the way down, yeah.
Yeah, and we did like other activities around the project, because I realized all these different things while you are running the project. So we would release a bird, and the bird would be landing on the beach, you know, at some beautiful isolated island, and we are following the birds as much as we can. And once I saw one of the birds we released, and he was like sort of walking on the beach, and there was loads of plastic. And I was really upset, because I thought, hey, you know, this is such a beautiful ecosystem. How come there's so much plastic on the beach? And it really bothered me. And then we started to work more and more with the local community on the plastic issue. And And so we started the recycle center for plastics in Pramuka Island, and now the local women there run it themselves.
Fab.
And even though, you know, it's just a little drop, you know, it's just a little thing that they are doing, but I do believe that they set a good example and they are recycling the plastics and reusing the plastics. What I mean is just, you know, it's not good to just look at one part of the problem, like, okay, we introduced the birds, but you have to look at the whole ecosystem around it and get the support from the local people, the communities that live there, and also, you know, do something about other issues that are there in the region.
Well,
So,
yeah. Oh, it's great. I love that you take a big holistic sort of approach to it all.
And we also started like bio rock coral reef projects. It started as a small experiment, but we worked together with the Gili Ecotrust in the Gilis because they also do it. And they advise, you know, there's this incredible woman named Delphine Robbe. She lives on the islands there and she's really focused on coral reef restoration. And she helped us in the Thousand Islands also. So there was also like a really important part of our program is how do we keep the reef healthy, thriving, and also fighting dynamite bombing that was still happening a lot. And educational programs for the kids and doing a puppet show. Puppet shows are always fun. Everybody loves puppet shows. So we like to create puppet shows that are fun and educative. That was fun. I mean, I love the islands. It's just a beautiful region. And you'll be surprised. There's so much marine life there and birds.
Oh, that's so cool. And I remember, I think it was on the Gili Islands when I mean, this is a year and years back, but there was like all on the beaches, you kind of just see. I was like, why is all this like dead sort of coral here and everything? Oh, that's just from all the dynamite fishing. It's just like, you don't even think about it until someone says it. And I was like, oh, right. Well, you mentioned them already, the traveling circuses. And like there was also, I know that you were a spearhead for the Free the Bartley Dolphins campaign. And that was quite a big story. It was the story of Johnny, Rocky and Rambo. That garnered quite a lot of attention, I think, in the media.
Yeah, so because we work with the government and we have like an MOU with the government, and we work on a national level, so we're not restricted to different regions. And when the Dolphin Traveling Show was operating, we were often in conflict with many authorities, you know, because the circus was legal. It was just operating legally. And it was just shocking how they could be operating legally, because it's the worst cruelty, you know, that you can imagine. I don't think I've seen anything worse. I mean, I keep saying that and then I see something worse. But then dolphins on a truck, and they were traveling from city to city. And also, I'll never forget, because we were investigating the circus for quite a while, I'll never forget the baby bear that, you know, was just craving for milk and food. And the guy tried to make him perform first, but the bear was just going for the food. And it was this struggle. And the cries of the bear, you know, it just goes through your bone. And I don't understand how people can sit there and watch this and believe that this is something okay. It just... You can clearly hear the distress and the fear and the pain, you know. But anyway, so we were investigating these circuses for quite a long time, to the point where we also traveled to where are the dolphins being caught, who's catching them, how I just tried to understand this whole trade. And then we reported back to the government. And of course, there's some government officials that really want also this, you know, this to stop. But then there's the others that already gave permits and are like, hey, you know, they're totally legal. So it was a... It became a very long campaign. And in between, we set up a rehabilitation facility with Rico Berry's Dolphin Project, because I try to work with experts. Yeah, I mean, especially like the dolphins. I mean, I've only done some courses, some marine metal medical courses, and I've worked with stranded dolphins. But yeah, you can be an expert in anything. I just had to learn so much. And when we started with this dolphin campaign, I reached out to Rico Berry, who's the famous trainer from Flipper, who then just turned against the industry and started Dolphin Project, Rico Berry's Dolphin Project. And I've been working with them ever since, and they've been extremely supportive of me and also the campaigns. So the campaign against the Dolphin Traveling Show lasted years, you know, years. I thought it's never going to end, because the permits kept being given every year, and the circuses kept going. And then some of the dolphins ended up in a swimming pool in Bali. So there were three facilities where they were kept in a swimming pool. And one was actually right next to the sea. So if the dolphins would peek out of the water from the chlorinated swimming pool, they could see the ocean. And I mean, these are very sensitive and highly developed animals that, of course, they knew that they were right next to the ocean, but they were stuck in this swimming pool. And luckily, that was closed down. They opened in 2013. They closed down in 2017. So we did a lot of campaigning. And also surfers in Bali stood up and protested. And, you know, this whole movement started from people from, you know, ranging from students from different universities all over the country. They were doing protests at the dolphin traveling circuses. So there were these dolphins stuck in swimming pools, and there were also these, you know, at steady locations. And then there were the circuses where they would travel by truck, and then a tent would be put up, and a plastic swimming pool with loads of chlorine in it, and the dolphins in it. Actually, when I first learned about these dolphin traveling shows, it was when we just started JAN as an organization, and we had our little office, and I received the phone call from a concerned citizen who was just watching the show. And she said, the phone call was like this, like, "Hey, you know, I'm now watching this dolphin show, and I'm in Bekasi, which is like a city connected to Jakarta, a very busy city. And I'm on a football field," because it was just a tent on a field. And yeah, and one of the dolphins died. So this is how I learned about the circus. And I was like, "Whoa, there's no way there's dolphins in Bekasi." You know, I just couldn't believe it. And then I traveled there with Pram and, you know, some of my team members, and Choki and this musician. We went there immediately together, because when the phone rang, they were all next to me, and we were like, we couldn't believe it. And then we did a protest the next day. And this is how it started. We just did a protest next day. We made a banner. We stood there. And this is how this campaign just started and lasted for 10 years. And then finally, the dolphin traveling shows were closed down in February 2020, like totally closed down, not allowed to operate anymore. And in August 2019, I received a phone call from the ministry that there were dolphins in a swimming pool in Bali, at a hotel, that also came from this dolphin traveling show. So this guy who was running the show was sort of renting them out or selling them illegally, you know. So they came from the dolphin traveling show, and they were in the swimming pool in a really horrific condition. And I went there already a few times, and we reported always to the authorities about their condition. And then the phone call came that I've been waiting for since forever, which was like, "Yeah, we would like to give you the opportunity to rehabilitate these dolphins. Do you think you can do it?" And I said, "Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm not saying no."
And
we're just gonna make it happen, you know. And if they can't be released, at least we can provide them a forever sanctuary in the ocean. You know, at least they have to get out of the swimming pool. I mean, it's unbelievable that in 2025, we still see dolphins inside a swimming pool. And so that's what happened. Then we went there. Then 2 days before the team, we all arrived, one dolphin died in the swimming pool. And I mean, the way they die also, it's so sad. Like, they just sink to the bottom. And the other dolphin, Rambo, was in the same swimming pool and just watching his friend, you know, taking his last breath. And then when we arrived, that pool was so disgusting. And I said, "Okay, the first thing we're going to do is clean this pool, because you can't keep them in there. The dolphin just died in there." And then the management of the hotel said, "Oh, you can't clean this pool. It hasn't been cleaned in 10 years because there's a problem with the ceramics, the flooring. So the only thing we can do is put the pump on so it keeps circulating and add more chemicals in the water." So basically, they were saying that people had been paying to swim with dolphins in a really contaminated swimming pool for all those years. And clearly, that's why the dolphins died, because they were swimming in their own feces. And to keep it clean, you know, just clean for the eye, the management just put in loads of chlorine in extreme levels. So when we tested the water, it was like 7 times more than normally a mammal can endure. So it was crazy. And you can imagine the damage on their organs, on their, yeah, just they
Mental.
must be suffering so much. And also, like, just think about how much, how painful it is when you go in a swimming pool with chlorine and you're swimming with your eyes open for an hour, and you really want to get out of the water. It's so painful. The chlorine is just hurting your eyes and your skin. And these dolphins are similar to us, but they are forced to stay in this water 24/7 for years. And just take a moment to let that sink in. Like, it's so cruel. So it was too late to help this dolphin that died, named Gomblo. And there were still 4 dolphins there. One was Dewa. And Dewa, he had this issue. It's like hurting himself. He was hurting himself. It's like you see it also with people. It's a mental thing where, they're so depressed or they're in so much pain, that hurting themselves make it feel as if the other pain goes away, or they don't think about the other pain. And it was as if that was happening with Dewa. He was throwing himself on the side of the pool every day. He was bleeding. He had wounds, and he never stopped. And the team there was just busy with putting like life jackets around the swimming pool and sort of trying to avoid him from hurting himself too much. But looking at it was just ridiculous. I mean, it was clear that he just had to get out of that swimming pool. And I said, how long has this been going on? I said, for years. It's just getting worse and worse and worse. But yeah, he's been doing this always. So, and then there was this other dolphin. His name was Johnny, and he was living in isolation, and he was always used to swim with with people that would pay just to swim with him because he was one of the calmer ones, the older ones. And yeah, and they would sort of hang on him, and then swim around the pool. And he was always alone. And it's so horrible because dolphins are so social. So then we placed Dewa with Johnny. So at least they could be together. And Johnny was so thrilled to have a friend. But Dewa was just in another world. He was just so in himself, and he couldn't care less about anything or anyone. And that was really hard to see. And then there were Rambo and Rocky, and they were the younger boys. And so what we did is we kept them together, and then we, tested their blood, and we did the general health check. We used the X-ray machine. We did a whiskey. We checked to try to understand more about their condition before we could say, okay, they can go on transport. And then we founded the first. I mean, it's the first one of its kind in the world, really. It's a rehabilitation center for dolphins. So while we were trying to keep the dolphins alive in that horrific swimming pool, and we bought a new pump and at least tried to do what we could, to keep them there stable until they could be moved, we had built the seapen in 1 month in the area where they were going to go. So we found this beautiful bay that was agreed upon by the government for us to use, and it was at the border of the national park. The water was crystal clear. There was not a lot of current, but enough to keep it moving, and but yeah, not too much current, so the seapen would be like unstable and not so many boats. So it was just perfect. And yeah, the national park authorities and also the central government gave us permission to use this, and the conservation authorities in Bali. So we worked with 3 partners. And then we moved the dolphins there. So first the Rocky and Rambo, and then Johnny and Dewa. And those, I think that, yeah, that's the most magical moment in my life. Just being able to lift them out of that swimming pool that was so disgusting and it was so painful for them, and into the ocean water, and just to feel their relief in a way of touching ocean water. Yeah, that was the best moment. Yeah.
Oh, I
And
bet.
then they stayed there for almost 3 years. There was COVID, and so yeah, and we observed them. We used hydrophones, and in the end, yeah, they were released in September 2022. But Dewa passed away way before that. They were passed away a few months after his arrival. And he was chronically ill. One lung had completely vanished because of the ammoniac in the swimming pool, which is what we found out later, and which is also something that could explain why he was always hurting himself so much, because he was in a lot of pain. And yeah, he had only one lung that was still half functioning. So
oh, bless him. But the other three, they were released. And I mean, have you heard anything, any recent news about them, or they went off and into the sunset kind of thing? Or
I wish they could just come back once in a while and
yeah, just
say,
check in.
we could check on them. But no, I mean,
did you tag them or anything? Or
yeah, we used GPS tagging, and Rocky traveled all the way to Australian waters.
Oh, wow.
And then Rambo and Johnny, they took it easier because Johnny was old. And he was actually, we were in the beginning in doubt if he could be released because he had no teeth. Because in a swimming pool, the teeth get damaged by the chlorine. And also the circus people, they would file their teeth flat. Because if people pay to take a photo with the dolphins, they don't want to see those sharp teeth. So they would file their teeth flat. Can you imagine? And so Johnny hardly had any teeth, but he still had the bases of the teeth in his mouth. So luckily, you know, we had a veterinary supervisor who was so committed to see what he could do to give Johnny teeth, and that he experimented with different types of cement, and he tried for 8 months to find the right solution. And then he came with it. His name is Paolo Martelli, and he came with this cement and, you know, the whole dental machinery that's needed, including the drill, but he didn't need to drill into painful areas. All we needed to do is Johnny to be voluntary receiving this treatment, because you cannot sedate a dolphin. You know, it had to be voluntary. And he did it. And it was like when we put the first tooth, he, with his tongue, he was sort of licking it and then looking around like, whoa, you know. I mean, his reaction was just so incredible. And then he came back for more and more. So he got 22 teeth, and then he could catch fish. And that meant that now we could release him, but we knew we had to keep an eye on him because he was older. He was very old. As it turned out, he was 50 plus.
Oh, wow. How long do dolphins live for? I don't even really know.
I don't think we really know, but at least 50. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. He was in between 40 and 50 for sure, but looking at the teeth and experts said he might have 50 or more. So yeah, he was very old. So it was also a really hard decision to make, you know. He was wild caught. All the dolphins with us were wild caught. I mean, this is also something to consider, of course, if you think about release. I mean, were they wild caught or were they not? But yeah, they were. So that's why eventually we said, yeah, we're gonna release them. I wrote a little book, you know, because I just want the story to be told. And it's called Swim Free. And I'm going to maybe publish it. I don't know yet.
Oh, great. Yeah. Plug away. Yeah. Plug anything you want to advertise. Feel free.
Yeah. I mean, that's just, if people are interested to learn more details about the dolphin story, then yeah, we have this little book called Swim Free. And
you'll have to let me know. I want a copy. Signed copy.
I will send it to you. Yeah,
yeah.
For sure.
Oh, amazing.
Just because I think it's important to have the story out right, because there was a lot of misunderstanding about what happened, especially when Dewa died. And you know, there were so many people that were against what we were doing, because they, you know, these are people that support the captive industry, and they don't want you to succeed, because that means the whole captive industry can turn around. And that's actually what we want, because we don't want to see dolphins in captivity anymore, especially not in, you know, swimming pools. I mean, this has to stop.
I think everyone should be able to agree on that.
I always felt like Big Brother is watching you, but not in a good way. Like always, like every step that we were taking, and there was a lot of criticism. But, you know, I felt we were doing the best we could, and we were giving everything for them, you know, and we really tried to do every step in the process very detailed. And always involving experts, you know, never taking decisions alone. And I mean, Rick O'Berry has years of experience. I mean, We learned so much, and having him also as a supervisor is, has been very, very helpful to make this a success. And then, of course, the veterinary supervisor, and just different experts from around the world that are also already involved with, for example, tagging dolphins, and who have experience with other, research that's being conducted with dolphins. We also listen to their sounds because they're acoustic animals, so you learn a lot by just listening to them. And it was for me a very special experience, especially because I've been working with wildlife for so many years, like, for example, orangutans, but it's really different in approach with the rehabilitation compared to the dolphins. The more you leave them alone, you just observe with the camera underwater from a distance, you listen to them. This is how you really learn about their behavior. And when we started to hear their echolocation, this is when we said, okay, things are gonna get better. Maybe there is a chance here that they can go back. Because in the swimming pool, they sort of switch it off. Yeah, they don't want to use that whole echolocation anymore because the sonar bounces back at them. And so there were all these incredible things, to think about and to monitor and collect data on the behavior. And I learned a lot from the dolphins, just how they communicate with each other and how they work together as a team. Incredible.
I love how collaboratively, like you're all working together to get this done. It's very inspiring. Hello, just me. That was something, wasn't it? You'll find some links in the show notes if you wish to find out more about Jan, and in the next episode, Femke and I do finally get to talk about bears, I promise. We also discuss rehab work and rescue work involving the dancing monkey industry. So once again, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. The Bear Den, the American Bear Association podcast, was written and presented by me, Philip Stubley. The music was composed by React Music. Thank you to everyone who has helped make this podcast possible, including Karen Hausman, Bill Lee, Clary Lee, Stephanie Horner, Donna Brazinka, Ross Coyer, and Angie Page. You can find out more about the American Bear Association at americanbear.org. You can find Vinshuti Wildlife Sanctuary on Facebook and Instagram. You can ask questions and submit comments about the podcast to pstubley@americanbear.org. The ABA is a special circumstance. We do not condone feeding wild animals. If you enjoy this podcast, help support the ABA either by donating, becoming an ABA member, symbolically adopting a bear, or come visit the sanctuary during the season and say hello. And if you do enjoy this, please do us a favour. It'll barely take you a minute. On whatever platform you're listening to this on, please either follow us or click the bell for updates and notifications. Please share with family and friends and rate the podcast, as it all helps us grow and is greatly appreciated.